I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Women fleeing the war in Sudan say rape is being used as a way to target the country's black African population, while both the Sudanese army and the rival Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have committed these atrocities. The UN says the vast majority of the rapes have been carried out by the RSF and its allied Arab militias. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
Social workers helping civilian victims of the war in Sudan say Arab militiamen working with the Rapid Support Forces are using rape as a weapon of revenge against entire communities, especially the Masalit ethnic group. Women who'd fled Darfur to neighbouring Chad told the BBC how they'd been raped multiple times. One traumatised 19-year-old had just found out she was pregnant. 2 decades ago, the same crime was being committed by fighters from the Janjaweed Arab Militia, which was then renamed the RSF. People in Sudan have long been desperate for a new era without the military in charge.
The authorities in Pakistan say they've killed 8 gunmen who attempted to storm Gwadar Port in Balochistan province. The deep-sea port is the gateway to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. The details from Caroline Davis.
The militants attacked the complex just outside the port, according to a government commissioner, detonating several bombs before firing shots. The Baloch Liberation Army, a prominent separatist group, claimed responsibility for the attack, saying they were targeting the Pakistani intelligence agency's offices on the site. It's not the first time Chinese targets have been attacked by separatist militant groups, who say they are fighting for a larger share in the region's mineral wealth.
Mexico's president has said his country will not accept deportations by Texas officials as a row intensifies over the U.S. state's attempts to send migrants back across the border. Andrés Manuel López Obrador described a Texas law empowering state officials to arrest and deport people suspected of illegal crossings as draconian, dehumanizing and unfair. Spanish police have raided the Madrid headquarters of the Spanish Football Federation in connection with an alleged corruption investigation. The home of the Federation's former president, Luis Rubiales, has also been searched. Guy Hedgecoe is in Madrid.
These raids were part of an investigation into contracts that moved the Spanish Super Cup to Saudi Arabia. The competition has been played there several times since 2020. The contracts are reported to be worth 40 million euros, or just over $43 million per year, and were signed with Cosmos, a company belonging to the former Spanish international player Gerard Piqué. A court is investigating allegations of business corruption and money laundering linked to the deal. However, both Mr. Piqué and Luis Rubiales have insisted that the Super Cup agreement they reached was legal.
This is the latest world news from the BBC. A senior Hamas official has said Israel has given a negative reaction to the group's latest Gaza ceasefire proposals. Speaking at a news conference in Beirut, Osama Hamdan accused Israel of retracting some of the approvals it had previously given to mediators. The Israeli government has yet to respond. The president of Vietnam, Vo Van Tuong, has resigned, reportedly because of a corruption scandal in his home province. Vo Van Tuong, a protege of Vietnam's powerful party leader, Nguyen Phu Chang, was appointed just a year ago to replace another president who stepped down over corruption. Our Southeast Asia correspondent, Jonathan Head, reports.
Changes in Vietnam's leadership are usually carefully planned and choreographed. So losing 2 presidents in just over a year, both over corruption scandals, shows that the Communist Party is finding it difficult to deal with the graft, which has become endemic in the country's fast-growing economy. When he was selected last year, Vo Van Tong was seen as a capable and relatively youthful president who had the advantage of being a protege of the powerful party chief Nguyen Phu Chang, the man leading the campaign against corruption. Now, like his predecessor, President Tong has also been forced to resign over unspecified links to a scandal in his home province.
Lawyers for Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni say she's seeking more than $100,000 in damages against 2 men who allegedly produced deepfake porn videos using her face. The indictment says the videos were uploaded to a porn site and viewed millions of times. French regulators say they'll fine Google more than $270 million for violating intellectual property rules. They say the company failed to respect commitments made to news publishers on how much to compensate them for the use of their content. Google says the latest fine is disproportionate. BBC News.
You wake up to the 8 o'clock buzz to get the week started.
Now, we need the help of a good volunteer to run our on-air operations each Monday.
Sure, that means waking up a little earlier.
To get to the station around 7:30.
But that's why WORT has coffee.
So that you can start your week off right.
WORT is recruiting a volunteer to run the soundboard each week on Monday mornings from 7:30 to 9 a.m.
You'd run all on-air operations for our morning program, The 8 O'Clock Buzz with Brian Standing.
No experience is necessary, but a familiarity with computers and a strong sense of punctuality and reliability are preferred.
For details, call 608-256-2001 and ask to speak with Shali Pittman.
Or head online to WORTFM.org/volunteer to fill out our volunteer application.
6'6" above sea level. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation.
Good afternoon and welcome to A Public Affair. My name is Rochelle Wilson, and I'll be your host this hour. This interview is pre-recorded, so we won't be able to take live calls today. You can let us know what you think by posting on the A Public Affair page on Facebook or on X, formerly known as Twitter, at WORT Talk. So you may have seen headlines like this over the past year or so. Can Ozempic fix America's obesity crisis? Ozempic is part of a new class of drugs that's sweeping the nation. Originally used to treat type 2 diabetes, drugs like Ozempic and Wegovy have seen a surge in demand as a weight loss aid, creating supply shortages and giving rise to a lucrative and growing off-label market. The discourse around these drugs has been problematic, to say the least. Many fat activists have pointed out that Ozempic can't fix what our culture has broken, as Tressy McMillan-Cottom wrote in a recent op-ed. So we're here to talk about it with Kate Mann. She's an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University and the author of three books. Her latest book is called Unshrinking: How to Face Fat Phobia. Kate, welcome back to A Public Affair.
Thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Thanks for joining us. I was super excited to dive into this new book. And as always, you delivered. So we're very excited to be talking with you about it today. So let's just kind of start with the, Let's start with the basics here. What exactly is fat phobia and how do we see it play out in society?
Yeah, so I see fat phobia as the unjust downranking of larger bodies, fat bodies, those are terms I use synonymously, in a number of respects, in terms of our moral status, in terms of our intellectual credentials, in terms of our aesthetic or sexual value. And I also think it consists in certain exaggerated, overhyped health moral panics about how unhealthy fat people are, how we're doomed to die of our fatness in ways that are, as I say, exaggerated and don't reflect the more complex, nuanced science of the relationship between weight and health.
And one of the big arguments in your book is that fat phobia is a serious form of oppression and that its effects have been underestimated. And I feel like when I read that, it made perfect sense to me. A light went off. Fat phobia feels like one of the last dominoes to fall when it comes to discrimination that people can just openly have in society. There are a lot of popular TV shows that just casually depict fat characters as stupid or undesirable, like you were saying. So why do you think fat phobia has been so persistent in our society and not taken seriously as a social justice issue?
Yeah, I love that question because it is so important to see that fat phobia is a form of oppression that really dogs fat people in so many areas of life. So one of the reasons that I view fat phobia as systemic is that we see it really affecting people across the life cycle in numerous important domains. So we see it in education. We see it in the way fat children are bullied by peers and regarded as less competent and talented by their teachers. We see it in the way that fat people get far less employment opportunities, and we see it in the way that fat people are discriminated against in really rampant, gnarly ways in the healthcare system. So I think that one of the reasons fat phobia persists is that, look, a lot of Americans, it's no surprise to say, are fat. So between 2/3 and 3/4 of us, by some measures, are fat. And yet we often regard ourselves as really a thin person waiting to emerge victorious after the next diet or exercise program. So we don't really stand in solidarity with other marginalized fat folks and still larger people. Rather, we try to change ourselves rather than work on changing the systemic oppression that I argue is really what's plaguing us.
Well, there's an intersectional quality to this, too, that really shows throughout your book. You also are talking about the ways that this intersects with racism, the ways that this intersects with sexism. Can you talk a little bit more about that for us here?
Yes, absolutely. So I think that one of the reasons fat phobia is really concerning is that it is this subject of real complacency on the left. So people of my political genre, people who are liberals or leftists or progressives, as I identify myself, really tend not to worry as much about fat phobia, even though it intersects with every other major form of oppression. So, for example, it is, I think, really clearly rooted in racism, in anti-Black racism specifically, in ways that have been brilliantly illuminated by the sociologist Sabrina Strings. So Strings argues that anti-Black racism was really what got fat phobia off the ground in the mid-18th century when the transatlantic slave trade was burgeoning. So until that point, there have been bits and pieces of fat phobia. I don't want to suggest that fat phobia is wholly new in human history until that point, but it really was a more ambivalent relationship with the fat body. Fat people were often regarded as prosperous, and their fat bodies a sign of wealth and luxury and abundance and having enough money to buy food. But it was in the mid-18th century that white racist pseudoscientists began to invent this idea of a fat Black body. And it was at that point that once fatness and Blackness were associated, fatness fell into disrepute and was a sign of being quote unquote primitive or depraved, all these other incredibly racist stereotypes and noxious images. So I want to be very clear here that it's not that fatness was derogated and then fatness and Blackness were associated via this pseudoscience. It was that fatness was associated with Blackness and then came to be derogated shortly thereafter as a way to justify the transatlantic slave trade that was enslaving Black people so brutally during that era. And so fat phobia is both rooted in anti-Black racism, but it continues to perpetuate it today with, we see fat Black men in particular being brutalized by white racist police officers and even murdered by racist white cops, partly on the basis of their body size. So as Deshaun Harrison argues brilliantly in their book, Belly of the Beast, we've seen men like Eric Garner in Staten Island, a man like Michael Brown in Ferguson, subject to these state executions, partly because they're viewed as quote unquote beastly and their body sizes are viewed as a sign that they're a threat to these racist white officers. And so we can see that fat phobia is intersecting with anti-Black racism today to have sometimes tragic and fatal consequences for large Black men, as well as Black women, who are subject to enormous amounts of what Moya Bailey calls misogynoir, the intersection of anti-Black racism and misogyny in America today.
Yeah, that was really helpful to read about in your book. And it was something that really, I guess maybe didn't surprise me, but it was very disheartening and to see those things come into play. Now, in your previous books, you've written about misogyny and you've written about male entitlement, and I'm wondering how gender comes into play when it comes to fat phobia.
Yeah, I'm so glad you asked that because I think it has a really big influence. And this is the part of the book where I get into what I call sexualized fat phobia or sexual fat phobia, where people are reliably denigrated on the basis of their fatness, especially as girls and women, and I would argue also non-binary folks too. Now, I want to be clear that I think fat men also face sexual fat phobia, but I don't think it's quite as pointy as it is for fat women, who are subject to things like hugging or a pig roast, these incredibly toxic terms for the misogynistic practice of fraternity brothers competing to see who can bed the heaviest or fattest woman and winning competitions on the basis of this prize, quote unquote, pig of a fat woman. And we see this in ways that fat girls and women are also really subject to scrutiny and body surveillance from their parents, from teachers, from doctors, and on the dating market. This is something where fat women are just systematically seen as less than, even though if you look at the consumption of pornography, it actually shows that fat women are a really common search term in pornography. So at some level, fat women are being regarded as highly desirable by a considerable portion of the porn consuming population, which is frankly most people. And yet we see that when it comes to actual social status, that's where fat women are regarded as, if I can put it this way, someone who you might sleep with, but not necessarily want to date openly or marry, particularly on the part of white entitled men who often have a sense of, yeah, that entitlement to date a quote unquote hot woman and marry a hot woman rather than someone who they might be sexually attracted to, but not want to introduce to friends or family.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Rochelle Wilson, and today I'm joined by feminist moral philosopher Kate Mann to talk about her new book, Unshrinking: How to Face Fat Phobia. Since this interview is pre-recorded, we can't take live calls. You can tell us about your experiences of fat phobia or thoughts on today's show by emailing talk at WORTFM.org, posting on the A Public Affair Facebook page, or tweeting at WORT Talk on X. So, Kate, we've just been throwing around this term fat, and you outline in your book why exactly you're using that word as opposed to maybe euphemisms that people might consider more flattering or medical terms like obese. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so I'm following here in the footsteps of many people in the fat activist or body liberation tradition by trying to reclaim the word fat as a merely neutral description of some bodies. So fat can just be regarded as a term that is matter of fact, like terms like short or tall, or for that matter, thin, as not having any shame or pejorative quality associated with it, but merely being a way that some bodies like mine simply are. And to me, that is a more useful term and is less euphemistic than terms like fluffy or chubby or curvy or Rubenesque or whatever it is. It's also a less gendered term, which is kind of nice. And I think it is less stigmatizing and alienating than medicalized terms like quote unquote overweight or obesity, or even person with obesity or person with overweight, which is a real mouthful. It's not a very natural term. And it's also a term that I think retains the sense that fat bodies are pathological rather than, as I see us, as a merely normal, natural, healthy human variation where fat people have always existed, we will always exist, and our bodies don't need to be pathologized or regarded as abnormal. And that can be reflected in our terminology.
Yeah, let's talk about health for a minute, because one thing that fat liberation activists and advocates of the Healthy at Every Size movement hear all the time is that people aren't fat phobic. They're just following the conventional scientific wisdom about fatness or obesity being unhealthy and directly correlated to worse health outcomes. What is your response to that argument?
Yeah, so I think there is a relationship between weight and health, but it's actually quite surprising to some people. So the best, most robust epidemiological evidence we have about this comes from research led by people like Catherine Flegel at the CDC, an award-winning CDC scientist. And she showed that the relationship between weight and health looks like a U-shaped curve, with people who are in the quote-unquote overweight category, who have a BMI between 25 and 30. So I hate the BMI for reasons we can get into. It's also based on racist pseudoscience. But just to use it as a reference point, those people who are in the overweight category have the lowest mortality rate, statistically speaking. So that's right, people who are overweight have the lowest all-cause mortality. People who are even quote-unquote moderately obese, so having a BMI between 30 and 35, have the same kind of mortality profile as people who are in the quote-unquote average weight category, which, by the way, is not an average weight for most Americans. It's also called the so-called normal weight category. So people who are even moderately obese do not have elevated mortality statistics compared to people who are in the average or normal weight category. Now, we do see that people who are underweight or people who are more than moderately obese have elevated health risks and elevated mortality on account of that. But that doesn't necessarily mean that their weight is driving those outcomes. So this is correlation. It's not necessarily causation, because what we see at those very high weights, which kick in these correlations at a BMI of maybe 35, maybe 40, depending on which studies you're looking at, those increased mortality statistics could also be due to things like very inadequate healthcare for people who are over a certain weight, the stress of stigma, which has marked health ill effects. So the very fact that people who are heavier are stigmatized may be partly driving health ill effects, as does the fact that there could be confounding variables. Like, it could be that people who are very heavy are also getting less exercise, which we do know is very good for the human body, partly because people who are very heavy often have less access to exercise where they won't be belittled and made fun of. So that may be accounting for both higher weight and increased mortality statistics. So in other words, we don't really know that sheer fat is driving health ill effects in those high weight categories. But even if it was, even if we do eventually discover incontrovertible evidence that very high weight simply causes ill health, I really want to emphasize that the concern trolling about people's health isn't helpful. So most people who are in larger bodies are all too well aware that our bodies are larger. We're all too well aware that the supposed remedies for high weight are diet and exercise. We may be more aware than the thin person who is advising us that diet and exercise, in fact, don't tend to work to reduce people's weight in the long term. So in the short term, diet and exercise can reduce people's weight by a moderate amount pretty reliably. But study after study and the most comprehensive meta-analyses to date show that for the vast majority of people, the weight comes back inexorably. So even if someone is in a very fat body, even if they are someone to whom their fat is driving health outcomes that are adverse, it doesn't necessarily follow that we can do something healthy that does more good than harm to reduce their weight. And they certainly still deserve to be treated humanely, compassionate, and given good health care, even if they are subject to health risks. The idea that someone should be treated poorly within the healthcare system because they're less healthy, if that sounds wild, that's because it is. So I hope that gives listeners a bit of a picture of why this is actually a complex, nuanced relationship, and why the advice to just lose weight is far more tricky than concern trolls would have us believe.
And you cite research in your book, a lot of it actually, showing that diets don't work, and that weight cycling is much more harmful to the human body than just being a given weight, even if that weight is above, quote, average. But there's still just this widespread belief that diets are effective and they fuel a multi-billion dollar industry. So what's it going to take to change the script on this?
Yeah, this is so well known scientifically that what happens, according to not just one study or two studies or three, but meta-analyses that really take every longitudinal diet study to date. So these are meta-analyses that look at what happens to dieters over a 4 to 5 year period. And it's been done by the best researchers in the business like Tracy Mann and Janet Tamayama, who collect all of these studies and do these meta-analyses showing that what happens to dieters is they lose a moderate amount of weight, maybe 5, maybe 10, sometimes maybe 15% of their starting weight, But the weight comes back really inevitably for the vast majority of people over a 4 to 5 year period. So it seems like, according to some people working in this space, the body essentially has a starvation response to dieting, even if it's quote unquote healthy dieting. The body can't really differentiate between caloric restriction that's quote unquote healthy and caloric restriction that would be experienced in famine. And so the body tends to go then into overdrive in stimulating appetite, in slowing down metabolism, which has been shown in people like contestants in The Biggest Loser. Their metabolisms slowed 30% on average 5 years, even after they had that drastic weight loss, meaning that most people will regain a substantial amount of the weight they lost. In the majority of cases, weight regain will be total or nearly total. And in between 1/3 and 2/3 of cases, people will actually end up heavier than they started if they undertake a diet. So what Mann and Tamayama say about this is that it appears that weight regain is the rule, not the exception, when it comes to dieting, and that dieting is actually an excellent predictor of weight gain rather than long-term weight loss. And non-dieters don't appear to be harmed in terms of weight gain by not dieting and trying to shrink their bodies. Rather, weight maintenance appears to be what generally happens to people who don't engage in those dieting efforts. So yeah, despite this, I think that many of us are frankly gaslit into still thinking that the next diet or the next diet and intense exercise program is going to shrink our bodies permanently, when that's just not the way the data shakes out. And I should say too that, look, dieting is not healthy for us in numerous ways. So what tends to happen, as you pointed out, Rochelle, is that when people diet, they regain the weight, but then they will go on another diet and so be repeatedly losing and regaining weight, which is known as weight cycling. And that turns out to have independent health ill effects, like to metabolic function. It actually increases rates of type 2 diabetes. It has cardiovascular ill effects. It has immune dysfunction effects, and it has mental health effects that are detrimental. So it looks like dieting doesn't reduce weight in the long term. Rather, it leads to weight cycling, which is independently unhealthy for people, regardless of their starting weight. But I think we're very much gaslit into keeping on this train and continuing to try this. And yeah, I should add that unlike dieting, exercise has been consistently shown to be very healthy for most people, but it doesn't appear to reduce people's weight again in the long term. It's something where people can do a lot of exercise, but generally their appetites will compensate for exercise. And in the long term, they will not end up lighter, though unlike dieting, they will often end up far healthier for being fitter.
Yeah. And speaking of that connection, you know, I think a lot of us still think that we can just clock someone else's health or even our own by looking in the mirror or looking at someone and perceiving the size of their body and, you know, bigger is less healthy and smaller is more healthy. And you mentioned BMI before. Talk to us a little bit about why BMI is kind of the worst and should be debunked.
Yeah. So, I mean, I am someone who was frequently judged as unhealthy based on my body size when I was significantly heavier. And I was someone who was in the quote unquote severely obese category, which means having a BMI of over 40. And as it happens, I was healthy and active and had excellent blood work and didn't have any health complications and would have been happy but for the fat phobic world in which I had to live. I'm actually much less healthy, I think, at my current weight, which is lighter, following extreme restriction that my body is still recovering from. So I now identify as a quote unquote small fat person, which is a term that fat activists use to differentiate various degrees of privilege along the fat spectrum. So it's useful to distinguish between small fat, mid fat, and large fat bodies. And I identify as a small fat person. But yeah, at a lighter weight, I'm not healthier, even though people assume that I am. I'm someone whose metabolism has slowed to a crawl and who has to deal with a lot of immune dysfunction and vulnerability in terms of getting just more illnesses and being more subject to the kinds of seasonal colds and flus that now knock me sideways, being cold all the time, just struggling in various basic bodily ways that I didn't at a higher weight. So that's one piece of it. And in terms of the BMI, this has a really interesting history. So it was invented by Adolphe Quetelet, who was a 19th century Belgian astronomer, who theorized that the average body was the ideal one. And if you're asking why that should be, why would average be ideal? That's a good question to which there's no logical answer. That was just his theory. There's no reason to think that that's the case. But he also based his measurements for his Quetelet's index, as it was called, on French and Scottish white European men. So this was a scale that was in no way tailored to most people in the human population. It was based on 19th century European white men. And then it was adapted in the 60s and 70s by Ansel Keys, who developed this Quetelet's index into what we now know as the BMI or body mass index, which is just a function of weight and height again. But Keyes was drawing from a slightly more diverse group of people. Namely, he included some Southeast Asian and also Bantu African men, although he didn't draw from a representative sample even of Bantu men, but it was purely a sample of men who fed into measurements for the body mass index. And it was mostly, again, white men who comprised the basis for these measurements. So why we should be judging people's bodies on this curve that doesn't pinpoint a reliable relationship between weight and health, as shown by the fact that supposedly overweight people have the lowest mortality statistics on average, and the fact that there were literally no women who went into establishing these metrics for the population, and the fact that they were always meant to measure population level health rather than to think about individuals' health. That's also a piece of why the body mass index is garbage. And we should also just reflect on the fact that different groups of people often have different weights at which their bodies naturally fall because of things like differences in bone density, in terms of muscle mass. Black women, for example, are really poorly served by the BMI because they happen to have the highest average BMI of any comparable subgroup, but also have very few health problems at supposedly elevated BMIs compared again to comparable subgroups. But yet they're being subject to these at least white-centric and arguably racist standards of what our body should be for no logical reason.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Rochelle Wilson, and today we're talking to Kate Mann, professor of philosophy at Cornell University, about her new book, Unshrinking, How to Face Fat Phobia. This is a pre-recorded interview. If you want to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you via the A Public Affair page on Facebook or on Twitter/X at WORT Talk. You can also email talk at WORTFM.org. So, Kate, you are a moral philosopher and you bring that to bear in this new book, Unshrinking. And I want to talk a little bit about some of these like so-called bioethics that come into play when it comes to fat people and especially the Peter Singer of it all. So can you talk a little bit about, you know, what we sometimes hear about fat bodies imposing a burden on society and why you reject that idea?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting to see how unexamined people's ideas about fat bodies are, even when we're, as philosophers, professionally tasked with thinking clearly and critically about the kinds of moral principles that we should be deploying in relationship to everyone's bodies. So the famous Australian bioethicist and moral philosopher Peter Singer theorized that fat people should have to pay more for their airline seats based on their body weight, which is so stigmatizing and so discriminatory. And his argument was so flawed. His idea was, well, if you have to pay, I don't know, $200 extra for 100 pounds of excess baggage, then why shouldn't you have to pay that same amount for 100 pounds of your own body? And the answer to that is both that it's incredibly stigmatizing of people in larger bodies, but also that it's not like, as he put it, the airline should be imposing on people the full cost of their flying. Airlines charge huge amounts of money for so-called excess baggage, not because they have to, but because they can. Their pricing model involves holding airline tickets as low as possible, getting people in the door, and then charging outrageous surcharges for anything extra people might need, including things like excess baggage, including things like just Wi-Fi or food, or even having the supposed privilege of getting extra boarding time or whatever it is people might need. They will often have pricing models that incorporate those charges. So there was no defense of this argument, as far as I could see logically. It was just assuming that fat bodies were a burden on other people in ways that are really ubiquitous in social discourse. So we often see this idea that fat people are a burden on the healthcare system. And that is, in fact, not accurate when you look at the idea that people who are larger are often going to cost a little bit more in terms of healthcare during their lifetime, but we will die on average because of this being skewed by people at very high weights a couple of years earlier on average. So our lifespan might be about, you know, 3 or 4 years shorter on average. So we actually end up costing the overall system less as a result of this on average because of something that is similar to what's called the smoking paradox. So similarly, smokers often cost the system more during their lifetimes, but smokers die markedly earlier on average, and so end up costing the system less because of their total lifespan and obviously not needing healthcare postmortem. Similarly, people who are in larger bodies don't, I think, tend to cost the system more on average because we die a little bit earlier. And we should also just reflect that whatever the case, calling people a burden on the system to begin with, I think is really suspect. When people do run risks in their lives to their health and they're in presumptively thin, fit bodies, we don't tend to regard them as a burden whatsoever. So in the book, I compare this discourse about fat bodies, which I think is so toxic and problematic, to people who go deep sea diving or mountain climbing or Grand Prix racing, things which are really noticeably risky and which may require humane and fitting healthcare when people run into problems, which as many as 1 in 10 people who do Grand Prix racing will have incredibly difficult recovery situations based on conflagrations and crashes. And yet we don't regard them as a burden on the healthcare system, which raises the question, why are we regarding fat bodies as a burden on the healthcare system to begin with? So maybe we should just accept the fact that people often do require different levels of healthcare. And that is just part of living in a society where some people run more risks than others. Some people have more risks that attach to their body than others for no particular reason that they can help and should be regarded as having that right to humane fitting healthcare regardless of those potential health risks, those potential needs that are valid and legitimate.
Yeah, I've been thinking a lot about that example that you give in the book about a hiker who may get lost and then require search and rescue, which I'm sure is a very expensive operation. And it's not like that person's taxes go up or that they're sent a bill. I mean, I don't know. We're in the U.S. Anything can happen. But in general, as a society, we don't consider hikers, you know, a burden on society because of something like that. And that has just really stuck with me. And I thought it was a really illuminating example. And I just, the book points out a lot of things like that. And you do a lot of thought experiments in the book. So you kind of play with this idea of what if we could have everyone, you know, take a magic pill that would make them thinner without any side effects. And, you know, what's your response to that? How are you thinking about this thought experiment?
Yeah, I was interested in this because of obviously the advent of drugs like semaglutides, Wegovy, Ozempic, and so on, and other GLP-1 receptor agonists that do reduce people's weight more than diets and exercise do, at least. Where I should say that one thing I say in the book is that these drugs actually do have severe costs and side effects at the moment. And that's a really important piece of talking about this in a compassionate, sensible, sober way, together with the fact that these drugs are not going to make everyone thin, because they, by optimistic estimates, will take about 15% of someone's starting weight off, which will still leave very fat people, at least fat, possibly very fat. So these drugs are potentially being overhyped in ways that are problematic. But still, we can do the thought experiment. What if these drugs were, by their own lights, perfect and had no costs, no side effects, and did make fat people thin, truly thin? And the truth is that I think there would be something really sad about a world where everyone had the same body type. I think of things like body diversity in terms of size, in terms of fatness, shape, diversity too, as a normal and beautiful human variation. I think that it's in some ways like imagining a world where we all had the same skin tone or hair texture. There is something very scary and eugenicist and flattening of human diversity of a kind that I really value and that I think we need to be embracing, rather than thinking that everyone should be the same size and shape. Now, I should say, I think that individuals are entitled to do what they want with their bodies. I think an individual would be entitled to take this magic pill we're imagining. But what I want readers to understand is that no one is obligated to shrink their bodies out of a sense that they're really going to be a better person in some way for being a small person, a thin person. And I also think that there's something valuable for those of us who can manage it about sticking to our guns and representing larger people in ways that are a valuable form of human diversity for the sake of representation and body diversity more broadly. So again, it's not an obligation to remain in a fat body, but I think there is something impressive about people who can be themselves unapologetically in their fat bodies in a way that makes life better for all of us ultimately in having a more diverse world, rather than understandably but somewhat sadly, put it provocatively, caving to the pressure to be a shrunken person.
And in the book, you actually write about some of this process that you went through yourself about finally breaking up with diet culture. And you call this a, quote, mundane but hard-won victory. So what all went into making that decision and moving through it?
Yeah, when I say that there's something admirable about the unshrinking person, I should say that I've spent decades trying to shrink my own body. So I say all of this with so much compassion and love for anyone who is still on this journey. I think it's a really difficult journey, and I don't want to underestimate the difficulties of really divesting from diet culture definitively and really coming to grips with all of our internalized fat phobia. Even as people who are fat or very fat, we have this to reckon with. But for me, it was going on another really extreme restrictive diet after having my daughter and realizing that I was modeling for her a way of living that I didn't want her to see her mother going through, that I didn't want her to see someone who was fat being not proud and unapologetic and, yeah, unshrinking in the face of fat phobia, but someone who was trying to severely restrict my eating and even just fast for days at a time in ways that I felt would be really damaging for her to watch growing up. So it's a bit of a cliche, but it was the journey of parenthood that finally persuaded me to wrestle with all of this and to stop dieting once and for all and just learn to live with my fat body. And I'm not saying that it's always easy or that I never have negative thoughts or temptations, but to really put the personal where my politics was and to let myself be who I am, which is a lifelong fat person. That felt like what I needed to do in order to model for her the kind of relationship with my own body, the unapologetic relationship that I wanted her to see her mother instantiating.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Public Affair on WORT 89.9 FM Madison. My name is Rochelle Wilson. I'm your host today, and I'm joined by feminist moral philosopher Kate Mann to talk about her new book, Unshrinking: How to Face Fat Phobia. We're pre-recording this interview, so we can't take live calls today, but you can tell us about your experiences, your thoughts, and your comments on the show by emailing talk at WORTFM.org, posting on the A Public Affair Facebook page, or tweeting at WORT Talk on X. So, Kate, before we started this interview, I actually asked you to read a passage for us from your book, something that really moved me, and I would love for everyone to hear it. So would you mind reading that out for us?
I'd love to. So this is a passage which comes a bit after I've talked about Peter Singer and other bioethicists who essentially thin-splained to fat people that we should shrink our bodies, as if we're ignorant of the idea that we can do that, at least temporarily, by diet and exercise. I joke that you'd have to be a fat, rock-sheltered Martian not to have heard of these options. But then I talk about the way that I think fat people are not intellectually in need of lecturing. We're actually possessed of a lot of useful knowledge about our bodies that should be of interest to people who are working in the bioethical space and more broadly. So here is the passage. As fat people, we of course know all too well that we are looked down upon for our weight, and that far from making us smaller, stigmatization frequently leads to further weight gain. We are also the ones who know that while living in a fat body may be hard, it is fat phobia, not our fatness, that primarily takes a toll on us. We are the ones who know that fatness is not a death sentence, and that depriving oneself routinely, as diets demand, is not trivial. We are the ones who know that far from being undisciplined, fat people are often extremely disciplined. A lifetime of dieting will make some people's will iron. We are among those who know that an iron will is about as much good as bootstraps in a world that hates you and wants to shrink you. And we are among those who know the most about certain facets of the human condition. For example, we can help dispel the fantasy that bodies are reasonable, by which I mean subject to rational control and capable of being wrestled into submission via that suspect thing called mastery. For bodies are not reasonable. They bend, they sag, they break. They get fat. They get old. They get ill. They become disabled. They die ultimately, and we die with them. That is, of course, frightening. Doesn't everything die at last and too soon, in the words of Mary Oliver? But our bodies are ourselves, as the feminist slogan has it. We are not separate from our bodies, nor are our bodies divided up between the better and the worse parts of our mortal souls, Pace Plato. And when it comes to our appetites, we are all in the end wild ones. So we will have to learn to live with and in our physical selves in all of their glorious and infuriating vulnerability and intransigence. The body's resistance to weight loss is only the beginning.
Thank you so much, Kate, for reading that. That passage was so moving to me when I read it, and just now too. It brings a certain...
Thank you.
Yeah, you know, I love how you are able to bring a kind of poetry, literally with Mary Oliver, but also in your own words about the experience of being in a body, even one that's hated by society. And you talk beautifully here and elsewhere about the concept of appetite, which normally has a negative connotation. Can you tell us more about that and how you've kind of rehabilitated some of these concepts that are normally thought of as negative?
Yeah, totally. I mean, I think that there's something so backwards about diet culture that tells us basically to be ashamed of our appetite when our appetite is something that keeps us going back for sustenance and the nurture and comfort and sheer survival necessity of eating regularly. I mean, there is something about this fat-phobic ideal of thinness or a shrunken body that is so powerful that we have forgotten in some ways that appetite can be healthy. It can be wonderful. It can be a source of not just sustenance, but pleasure and community and connection when we have to eat roughly 3 times a day, often in the company of loved ones and in ways that are such a reliable source of pleasure. So I talk in the book about the authority of hunger and the fact that both being hungry itself and also what we have a specific appetite for is something that we can regard as authoritative and honor in ways that follow the dictates of our own bodies in ways that have been gotten at by the idea of intuitive eating, which is a concept that might be familiar to some listeners and not to others. But basically, it's the idea that a lot of the sense of being out of control around food, which again, I completely sympathize with anyone who is in that place, but a lot of that is rooted in restriction. So a lot of people find that they're binging or having real trouble regulating their appetites in ways that are a reflection, not of the fact that they're inherently prone to overeating, but the fact that our bodies and brains go a bit haywire when we are trying to restrict much of the time. So, intuitive eating counsels us to actually eat when we're hungry, not when we're full, but to eat to the point of satiety in a way that is unapologetic and that does have us eating foods that we enjoy and find satiating and satisfying and pleasurable to eat, and that a lot of our appetites will learn to regulate, and we will be able to feel completely in control of our appetites and calm around food when we're not trying to restrict what we eat in this self-punitive and often implicitly fat-phobic way.
Yeah, you talk about this in such a beautiful and expansive way. And I'll admit that for myself, I had kind of started favoring the idea of body neutrality rather than body positivity because I didn't like the idea of constantly hyping myself up or focusing on looks and being beautiful and being fabulous, which sometimes can come out of body positivity. But, you know, upon further reflection, I'm also really wary of striving for neutrality because in reality, you have a lot of thoughts and feelings that you can and maybe even should be working through when it comes to your body and the world. And I read in your book about the concept of body reflexivity, which you propose. So can you tell us more about that and what it looks like for you?
Yeah, I'd love to. So I want to be clear that I don't begrudge anyone body positivity or neutrality if it works for them. I think that's great. But for me, body positivity feels a bit like toxic positivity. It feels a bit oppressive to have to be positive about our bodies all the time. I certainly can't maintain positivity really about anything. So why would I be positive about my body relentlessly? And similarly, neutrality feels tough too. Like it's fraught. Our relationship with our bodies for most of us. And so having to be relentlessly neutral about our bodies both can feel a bit depressing, a bit wan, a bit lackluster. But also, I began to think while I was researching this book, why do we have to be one way or the other about our bodies in this relentless, monolithic way? So when you have an idea of being body positive or neutral or negative, it's still the idea of implicitly assigning a number, a sort of quantitative measure to our bodies, be it positive or neutral or negative. And I began to think, well, wouldn't it be more liberating to throw out the scales of judgment altogether and not be assessing our bodies in any way whatsoever? So the idea that I found most liberating in my own thought is that my body is for me, your body is for you, and our own perspective on our body is the only one that matters. And so I call that idea body reflexivity, the idea that one's own body is for oneself and no one else. And it's this idea that the body is not there for consumption or comparison or correction. Really, it's meant to serve its denizen and no one else. And I'm sometimes asked, like, is this practical? Is this something we can really do, just having no judgment whatsoever about our bodies? But I think it is so possible. I mean, you know, I think about the attitude I have towards a bunch of kids when I see my daughter's four-year-old friends and her running around in the playground joyfully. The idea that we'd need to be body positive or body neutral about children's bodies sounds so creepy and weird. Like, they're just bodies. They're all great. They're wonderful. We don't need a judgment. We don't need an implicit comparison. We don't need to be positive because there's no prospect of being negative, I hope, towards children's bodies. So really, the idea of body positivity is this correction to the negativity and comparison that is leveled at the group of one group. It's leveled at a group of one group of people, namely girls and women, especially women. So when we throw out the idea of that judgment, that correction, that, frankly, colonization, I think we can just regard a body as there for its denizen and as no one else's business.
And in our last minute here, can you talk a little bit about how fat phobia affects everyone, regardless of their current weight or size? Because it might seem like this has a narrow application, but I really think that your book can speak to some of these broader social justice issues.
Yeah, totally. So I think that fat phobia definitely affects people in larger bodies the most. They're the people who are getting worse healthcare and not being subject to accessibility in public spaces. However, I think of fat phobia as metaphorically like a straitjacket. It certainly restricts fat bodies the most, but it threatens everyone not to get above a certain size. It says not to gain weight for people, even if they're in small or thin bodies. And it also says try to lose weight if you can, to many, if not most of us. And that is a very threatening message, since many of us will gain weight over our lifetimes. It's part of the natural aging process. If we're privileged enough to get to age, for many of us, weight gain is normal, necessary, often healthy. When it comes to especially women's bodies in menopause, gaining weight can be a very natural part of that process. And fat can be very protective for adults over 60, as many studies show. So the idea that fatness is something to fear and dread and rue and forestall is something that I think for most of us, we should be challenging and resisting.
And that brings us to the end of our show today. Thanks so much for joining us today, Kate.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great conversation and I so appreciate it.
Kate Mann is an associate professor of philosophy at Cornell University and the author of three books. We've been talking about her latest book, Unshrinking: How to Face Fat Phobia. Thanks, too, to all of you who listen and support WORT. This hour of radio was produced by Jade Iseri Ramos and hosted by me, Rochelle Wilson. Jade ran the soundboard, and WORT News Director Shali Pittman provided support. You're listening to WORT 89.9 FM Madison. Stay tuned, as always, for more great programming ahead on your favorite community radio station. The credit card just keeps on compounding, but the FCC can never shut this pirate sound down. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream, media distorted. We come and listen and supported. Live and direct, we come and never pre-recorded, with information that would never be reported. Disregard the mainstream media distorted. We come and listen and support it.
This is Pacifica Radio's Letters and Politics. On today's show,
only in the past several years that they began to like coordinate, etc., and become an axis. That is to say, there's no like head and telling them what to do. They are each independent in their own particular milieu. And the proof of that is what's happening right now, the coordination in fighting against the Israeli genocide.
A conversation on the so-called axis of resistance, a loose coalition made up of Iran, Hezbollah in southern Lebanon, Palestinian Liberation Groups, and the Houthis in Yemen, with a common aim to resist U.S. and Israeli power in the Middle East. Our guest is Brahim Aoud, Professor Emeritus of Ethnic Studies at the University of Hawaii, Manoa, and editor of the journal Arab Studies Quarterly. That's next on Letters and Politics. But first, the news.
I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. Hello. Women fleeing the war in Sudan say rape is being used as a way to target the country's black African population. After leaving Sudan's Darfur region for neighbouring Chad, traumatised women from the Masalit community say they were attacked by militias and in some cases raped multiple times. Mercy Juma has met the victims.
Sexual violence is a huge problem, but official figures are low because many victims do not speak out for fear of further victimization and social stigma. Zahra, both a social worker and a refugee, invited me to a space where she brings together survivors of sexual violence. I thought it might be just 5 or 6 women, but there were close to 40. Ordinary women in Sudan are paying the price for the brutality which has been unleashed by the conflict.
The authorities in Pakistan say they've killed 8 gunmen who attempted to storm Gwadar port in Balochistan province. At least one Pakistani soldier is also reported to have been killed. The deep sea port is the gateway to the China-Pakistan Economic Corridor, part of China's Belt and Road Initiative. The separatist Baloch Liberation Army said it carried out the assault and that it was aimed at Pakistani intelligence agency officers. The Mexican president has said his country will not accept deportations by